Okay, well, thanks very much for agreeing to talk to us about the double pulsars. Perhaps you just start off with a very easy question. How do pulsars actually pulse? What are they pulsing?
Well, they aren't actually pulsating as in going bigger and smaller. The pulsations you see come from a lighthouse effect. If you stand at a beach and you see a lighthouse, it's a pulsating light source. But in fact, it's a constant beam of light. It's just rotating. And the same thing happens with the pulsar, which has a radio beam along its magnetic axis. And so the magnetic axis is sort of inclined to the rotation axis, just like the Earth. The magnetic pole is not coincident with the rotational pole of the Earth. And so as the pulsar rotates, the beam sweeps out the region in space, sort of covering it with radio beams. And whenever the radio beam happens to point towards Earth and the telescope happens to observe it, you can see a pulse every time the pulsar rotates by.
So we know there's about, over 1,000 pulsars.
1,700 by now, yeah.
1,700 pulsars.
Mm.
Because it's such a beamed effect, these pulsars are beaming towards us. Presumably we can only see a pulsar if these beams are beaming straight towards us. So there should be more pulsars out there, which we can't see. Is that true?
Indeed, that's indeed true. We see probably only about a fifth of all the pulsars in the galaxy, potentially. I mean, we haven't discovered them all because our telescopes are not sensitive enough. But we reckon that there are about 100,000 active pulsars in the galaxy, of which about 20,000 are beamed towards Earth. And of those, we have discovered about 1,700 now. So still a way to go to see the others.
You need to have sensitive radio telescopes for this. How many telescopes are there in the world that can detect these pulsars?
It depends on which pulsars you're looking at. There are some pulsars which are really strong, which even small telescopes can observe, like the 30-meter telescope, 42-foot telescope here in Jodrell Bank. We follow a small number of pulsars every day. They're strong enough to be detected with such a small telescope. But to see the majority of the pulsars and to actually do some science with them, you have to have some big telescopes. And there should be about 100-meter class telescope to do some decent science. You can do some science with other 30-meter class telescopes as well, quite a bit actually. But for sensitivity and precision, you really need the big telescopes.
So why is the discovery of this double pulsar so interesting?
Various reasons, actually. It turns out it is not only an interesting laboratory for gravity, for which we have used binary pulses in the past, but it's also in such a fortunate geometry that we see the system almost completely edge on. So we see the orbit exactly from the side, which means the beam of one pulsar has to pass the other pulsar when it's directed towards Earth. And so we can actually study also all the physics of the plasma and the particles around the pulsar in that system. And it was one of the holy grails that we sort of were looking for, but we didn't really expect to find them, because they're very rare, and the chance that two beams are pointing towards Earth is pretty small. And it's born in a process which involves two supernova explosions, which are usually so violent that any binary system is being disrupted. And pulsars don't live forever, so you have to catch them in the right time when they're both active, and it's, as I said, beamed towards Earth. And so it was very unlikely to find such an object, but I was very lucky.
You mentioned binary pulsar systems. Mm. What's the difference between a binary pulsar and a double pulsar? What's the difference?
Yes, it's not so easy to see. Basically, a binary pulsar is a pulsar which has any companion. It could be, usually, typically, it's a white dwarf companion. That's the most common combination. We have a few systems which have a main sequence star as a companion. Of those, we have a handful by now. And the rarest class is where you have a pulsar with another Newton star as a companion. So a Newton star is not necessarily a radio pulsar. It has to be active and has to be pointed towards Earth to be sort of classified as a radio pulsar. So we had double Newton star systems in the past where one Newton star was visible as a pulsar and the other one was an unseen Newton star, where maybe the beam was pointing away from us, maybe it wasn't active, had already died. But in this particular case, we have two active radio pulsars orbiting each other.
How was the double pulsar discovered? Who discovered it?
it was discovered in a collaboration with a number of other people across the world. We used to do survey along the galactic plane and then eventually north-south of the galactic plane using the Parkes telescope. And so we discovered the first pulsar in the system in April 2003 when Marta Bergay from Bologna at that time was doing her last observations for the PhD and discovered that system, which this one pulsar, which was in a highly exciting orbit around another unseen Newton star. And we observed that system for a few months, and we'd always planned to have a look whether the other companion may be a radio pulsar pointing towards us, but we sort of were busy with teaching and other stuff. And so so Duncan Lorimer actually went to the telescope and did help us with the observations on the Parkes. And he has written some software to analyze some data, which we've taken with the Lovell telescope just the night before on a long integration towards a supernova remnant. And we need some special software to analyze this. And so he was looking for a data set to test this data on. And so the longest data set he had available readily for him was the observation of the pulsar system that he has done first a few hours earlier. So he just ran the data through his program, and suddenly there was this pulsation, a different frequency than the pulsar should have been there. And so that's how we finally learned about the existence of the other active radio pulsar in the system. The second pulsar is not always visible. It's only strong for two short phases in the orbit. And that is when it's sort of protected from the energetic wind that comes from the fast rotating pulsar we discovered first. Between the fast rotating pulsar, as we call it, A, is behind the companion and the Earth. And so that phase lasts only for, a number of minutes or so. And so we were always looking sort of at the wrong part of the orbit, and we hadn't just had the time to do the complete analysis to look at the whole orbit, which was planned, but Duncan was faster than us.
So apart from the one of the pulsars actually pulsing, sending out these radio beams, it actually turns on and off, or it seemed to turn on and off during parts of its orbit.
Indeed. It may not be completely turning off with new observation, more sensitive equipment and so on. We've seen it now also, albeit much weaker, at other phases in the orbit. At some of them, it's still too weak probably to be detected. But indeed, it's the first time that the visibility of a pulsar is modulated during its orbit, and that must come from the interaction with its powerful companion.
So there's a lot to learn just from the fact that one of the pulsars turns itself on and off.
It's a huge amount to learn. If you just look at the papers published by other colleagues, I mean, it's a whole industry by now. This is really the most exciting laboratory, both for plasma physics, for GR, and understanding pulsars in general. It's really an amazing system.
So what do we know about this binary pulsar system? The double pulsar system. How close together, for instance, are these, the two pulsars?
The orbit is somewhat eccentric. So it means that it's not a complete perfect circle. It's sort of ellipses. And the diameter of the orbit is about 3 light seconds, which translates to something like 900,000 kilometers, which is somewhat less than the diameter of the Sun. So that system would fit just about into the Sun. And the two pulsars orbit each other in this distance with an orbital period of 2.4 hours.
2.4 hours.
Yeah, so if you calculate that corresponds to orbital velocities of 1 million kilometers per hour. So,
1 million kilometers per hour?
Yep.
Fantastic.
It's 0.1% of the speed of light, and that already tells you that the system is an ideal laboratory to study effects predicted by Einstein, because we have massive compact objects, large speeds, and that's exactly where you would expect to see deviations from classical physics and see the effects of general relativity.
Tell us a bit about that. How can this fantastic physical laboratory teach us about general relativity, Einstein's general theory of gravity?
In Newton's physics, basically, and Kepler's law for that matter, binary stars are supposed, like planets, are supposed to move on perfect ellipses around the common center of mass. And Einstein showed with his theory in 1916, that the ellipses are not perfect, but as astronomers had observed for Mercury, after one full orbit, Mercury doesn't return perfectly back to the point where it started. The ellipse is sort of rotating in space, and that's called the precession of the orbit. And that was one of the first deviations that was observed as an indication that Newton's physics is not really complete. That takes about, the rotation of Mercury is tiny and very difficult to measure. While for the double pulsar, we see exactly the same effect, but on a much, much larger time scale, or the magnitude scale, and a much shorter time. It takes only 20 years for the whole orbit to rotate in space. That was the first relativistic effect that we measured for the double pulsar, because it was the most obvious one, the easiest to observe. Meanwhile, we have also measured that the orbit is shrinking every day by about 8 millimeters. So we have this 900,000 kilometer orbit, and every day it's shrinking by 8 millimeters.
This is remarkable. How far away is this double pulsar system from us?
It's about 600 parsec, which is about 1,800 light years. So it's relatively close to Earth, actually.
Still 1,800 light years away, and you can measure change in the orbit of 8 millimeters.
Yep, that's right. We do that by measuring the arrival times of the pulsars at Earth. And so we see that the orbit is shrinking because the orbital period is basically changing. The change in orbital period comes from the fact that as another factor of general relativity, if you have two massive objects orbiting each other, they should emit gravitational waves, which is basically if you look at a swimming pool and you throw a stone into the pond, you see some waves traveling outwards. That happens to space-times as well. And so energy is carried away from the system with the gravitational waves, and eventually the energy must be taken from somewhere, and it's taken from the orbital energy. And whenever you take energy away from an orbit, the orbit shrinks and the stars get closer together. And in this case, they will collide in about 85 billion years.
What will happen then?
It will probably form a black hole, and during that event, a huge amount of gravitational waves will be emitted. So yeah, it's still a bit in the future, but it's the sort of the closest system that we have, and so all our calculations, how often that may happen in the galaxy, and how often the gravitational wave people may detect an event like this, have suddenly been scaled upwards. We expect now almost an order of magnitude more of these events to happen than we had expected before. The other interesting effect, general relativity effect, is there are two more effects. When I just spoke about space-time, so space-time is deformed, curved around a massive object. So and I mentioned before that the orbit of the system is seen almost completely edge-on. So when the light of one pulsar, say A, is passing near the surface of B, it has to go through the curved space-time. So rather than going through flat space, it has to go through curved space. Hmm. And its curvature adds a bit of a delay, so the pulse arrives somewhat later than it would if space-time would have been flat. And we can measure this effect, and it's called Shapiro delay, because it was first proposed by Irvin Shapiro in the 1960s, and measured using Venus and Mercury in the solar system. And we see this effect. It's about a 90 microsecond effect that's clearly detectable again.
So when there's a background pulsar passing from that pulsar past the foreground pulsar to us, it takes a slightly longer to get to us, 90 microseconds. You can detect that difference.
That's right, yeah. And finally, the last effect we've seen so far, although we expect to see more in the future once we gather more data, is that the clocks in gravitational fields are going slower. So for instance, if you take two identical atomic clocks, leave one on the Earth's surface and take one clock on board of an airplane and fly around the Earth, you will see that after correcting for some other effects, that the clock on the airplane is going slightly Well, it was going slightly faster, and so it shows a later time than the clock on the Earth's surface, which was going slower. And that's because you're deeper in a gravitational field, and so the two clocks have different clock rates. And we see that exactly for the pulsars. If the pulsar, as I said, are in the eccentric orbit, the distance between the two pulsars changes slightly during one orbit. And this difference in distance is enough to make the clock rate of the pulsars to go slower and faster. And again, that's the modulation that we see in our data. And that particular one is 380 microseconds.
So these sort of very precise tests could only be done with a double pulsar system. It couldn't be done with a single pulsar and a neutron star, for instance.
All of these effects have also been seen in a pulsar with an unseen neutron star. But none of them, there wasn't any system which showed so many effects at once. So, for instance, for the Hals-Taylor pulsar, for which Joe Taylor and Russell Hartzberg got the Nobel Prize, we have seen the effects of the precession of the orbit, this slower clock rates in gravitational fields, and the shrinkage of the orbit. But, for instance, we hadn't seen the Shapiro effect. There are other pulsars for which similar effects are seen, but where we can't really measure the shrinkage of the orbit due to other effects. So here we have a system which suddenly combines all the effects in one single binary system. And in addition to that, what is unique in this particular case, we can measure two pulsars. So we, rather than having just one orbit that we can measure with one pulsar, here we have now two pulsars and two orbits. And that gives a fundamentally new constraint on these tests, because there's a law, Kepler's third law, which tells you that the distance to the center of mass is inverse proportional to the mass of the object. So the heavier object is closer to the center of mass than the lighter object. So by measuring the two orbits for both pulsars, we can immediately calculate what the ratio of the masses is. And that, it turns out, is independent of the theory of gravity. So if you want to describe the system properly by testing, for instance, general relativity, then GR has to predict a value which is consistent with this mass ratio. Mm. And that is a constraint that we have only in a double pulsar, because it's the only system where we have two pulsars with a build and we can measure both orbits. So it's a fundamentally different constraint. That makes this system even more unique.
So according to you and according to the double pulsar, was Einstein right? Was Einstein's theory right?
So far, as far we can tell, Einstein has also passed this test of flying colors, yeah. And we're trying to push the limits further and see if we can finally reach a point where we see some deviation from general relativity. It will be hard to swallow, but that's what we are aiming for.
Be very exciting.
Yep.
Thank you very much indeed.
You're most welcome.